Well, or, you know, in the case of Fox, I think Fox is, they have to have some kind of strategy. I can't believe they haven't.
It's called Nielsen.
I honestly can't believe they haven't tried to bring the X-Men, which is really, seems a natural to me, to television. Maybe because they don't have the rights, I guess. That would be a reason for that.
Well, we'll see. Fox started this year with the runaway hit Deadpool. They tend to think Deadpool was more luck than skill, plus a heavy dose of passion from Ryan Reynolds, who we can tie in as an effective. He's a fan and he's an actor.
Correct. And in fact,
so he would be. Would that make him a factor?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
A very strong factor.
Yes.
The X factor. Go away.
There is nothing wrong with your internet. Do not attempt to adjust. We are now in control of the transmission. We control the horizontal and the vertical. We can deluge you with 1,000 channels or expand one single image to crystal clarity and beyond. We can shape your vision to anything our imagination can conceive. For the next hour, we will control all that you see and hear. We are the Gentlemen Nerds. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Lobot Lounge, where the Gentlemen Nerds are gathering once again to discuss all things Hollywood. In tonight's very special episode, we'll discuss the changing face of Hollywood and how fan influence can affect big studio decisions. Gathered at the table and ordering your first round of drinks, Mark Finn.
Ready for my close-up.
Mickey Finn.
A studio has no name.
And Mr. Aaron DiOrive.
I got nothing.
Excellent. I'm Joseph Fotinos. I am your host and emotional touchstone. Welcome to the Lobot Lounge. Gentlemen, so good to have you.
Nice again. To be back. I hate it when we have to take a week off for real life.
I know. It does throw off the vibe. There's no doubt it throws off the vibe. But
real life throws off
back.
The vibe.
We're back with a vengeance. What started this particular topic, was a bunch of articles came out one after another talking about a variety of things, talking about fewer and fewer people going to see movies, Hollywood making fewer films but more of the big tentpole blockbusters that average 150 million or more. And they gamble big. They gamble big, hoping that they will get a return on the investment on one or two of these, and that pretty much floats them for the rest of the year. So there's less attention paid to the lower or mid-range budget movies in the 40 to 60 million. Those we're seeing fewer of. There's still a few that are made, but now we have new power players entering into the picture. We've got Netflix.
That's right.
With its dedication to spend apparently over $1 billion in new content. That's astounding to me. That lets you know how well Netflix is doing, with Amazon entering into the picture, with Apple TV wanting more and more content. Google TV is starting to get in on it.
And Sony's plan to dedicate a whole, 25 cents to its programming?
Yeah. Well, Sony has its own problems.
So Sony has one show on their network.
But and then
wait, Sony has a network?
Yes.
The PS4, yes.
With one show.
Which is the superhero. Remember we talked about the...
It's the one I like and Aaron hates.
Yeah. No, I actually like the comic, but the
so
show.
You have to have a PS to watch this station?
Yeah, you unfortunately do.
Or a DVD player, since it's out on DVD now.
There was another article that came out last week that sort of preempted the movie discussion. It's something that they've done for the last couple of years now, where they sort of handicap from all of the major television studios what shows live, what shows die, what shows get renewed, and so forth. And right on the heels of that, you know, of course, the internet took to lamenting the loss of Agent Carter. And
rest in peace, Peggy. And
one of the other Marvel shows, Marvel's Most Wanted, got axed before it got started. But then at the same time, ABC moved Supergirl over to the CW, and they've announced a four-way crossover between Flash, Green Arrow, Legends of Tomorrow, and Supergirl.
Really?
And so there's some power plays consolidating here. And
that's fan service. I mean, that's
absolutely.
The fans went ape poop. Can I say that? They went ape poop over
You can't. You have to say ape shit.
Okay.
No, then I have to bleep Aaron now. Now I have to bleep me.
Nope, you did it again. I said it again. I said the word. Fans went crazy. How about that? Over when Supergirl and Flash crossed over. I mean, it was just like, oh my gosh, this is brilliant. Why don't we do more like this?
Right.
I mean, and we're jumping. They were jumping networks, CBS and CW working together to produce this wonderful
had some
experience
great on the CW.
And but then when Constantine showed up on Arrow, fans went nuts.
Yeah.
They loved it. It was a great episode, you know? Uh-huh. So I think that they're all starting to follow that whole, and I want to say Marvel, but only because Marvel did it on the big screen and did it well, is when characters started showing up in each other's movies. Universal has now said that they want to do a whole slate of new monster movies modeled after the Marvel line where they can cross over. And this is not new, by the way.
Yeah, that's
Universal
ironic.
Monsters
have
been crossing over
from
you know, starting with Frankenstein meets the Wolfman all the way up into House of Dracula, or Abbott and Costello meet Frankenstein, if you want to go there. They've been walking around in each other's universes forever. But the Universal is now taking it seriously and want to form their own little Marvel, quote, style universe
of
monsters.
Monsters.
As
a shared world universe, I think that's a smart idea because
heroes
can cross over, villains can cross over, and you don't have to – I don't think you have to work as hard to get a movie that people want to see. If you have Van Helsing and Lawrence Talbot teaming up to fight somebody, and, of course, Van Helsing – knows he's got to keep an eye on Talbot because, you know, if we don't get this done before the 28th, I've got another problem on my hands.
Sure. Keep an eye.
Or timing it just right to say, you know what, we're going up against Dracula this time. Go.
Maybe we should wait until the 28th. That's right.
Now you can go get him.
We're going up against Kevin Bacon from The Hollow Man.
Mm-hmm.
That's the great thing that we love about the show Penny Dreadful, which we think is very successful.
Yes.
But they beat Universal to the punch on this new series of movies, and that they have a show that's all about Dracula and Frankenstein and the Wolfman.
Which is funny because it was originally
in the same universe,
just as a Frankenstein story. Which is why in first season the Frankenstein story seems so different in tone from everything else, is because that's the original story, and then they added to it when somebody had an idea.
They know exactly. And by the way, this is another thing that the article was addressing, talking about Netflix, is that the success that Netflix has found, that the big studios are not in a position to do, because a big studio has to make a movie that appeals to the greatest number of people possible in an audience.
Right.
So a lot of times we will see sort of the lowest common denominator. And people complain about Hollywood movies, and they're all the same, and they're kind of dumb, and blah, 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 blah. But it's very hard to make a movie. I mean, Hollywood, I don't care who you are in Hollywood, you don't set out to make a bad movie. Nobody does. And so it is sort of like alchemy, you know? Whenever you're trying to get all these elements together, and you're trying to get it to work, and you want a payoff of $500,000 domestic, $500 million, or $1 billion worldwide, it's very, very difficult. But Netflix has the demographics that they can look at and say, we know that there is a market, a niche for this particular sub-genre. So we're going to make a show that is targeted to these particular people or this particular group or that particular group. And they can afford to do that.
And the cool thing,
so they come up with shows that appeal to the guys that don't want any kind of science fiction. They just want steampunk. Well, voila, we got that. Or the guys that don't want just any kind of horror, they want haunted houses. Well, hey, we got that, you know. So that's something that the studios cannot do. They're these huge, bulky machines, and it's like steering a ship. It's going to take forever to get them to be able to have that kind of mobile content creation. They can't do it. They can't do it.
And the cool thing about Netflix versus like television is that television's still mired in the Nielsen ratings, which are a joke. And Netflix just goes, okay, we got people paying subscriptions.
Well,
they do have metrics as to which shows they watch, but it's not done like the Nielsen's.
No, television is figuring it out, though, because CBS has not gone over to join Hulu in its content sharing. In fact, CBS has its own app because they realize they've got a branded product. And you might not like the procedurals that CBS is turning out, but if you do like the procedurals, CBS is where all of the really good procedurals are.
And there's a lot of them.
That's right.
I mean,
and there's
a lot of people that like the procedurals, and there's
exactly.
a lot of procedurals.
And they've all got a different flavor, depending on if you want a MacGyver-flavored procedural or an ensemble cast flavored procedural.
Or hackers.
Or a cop, a straight up and down thin blue line style procedural. These things are the deal. Everybody else is over on Hulu, and you're watching it the next day after. So
yeah.
the matrices that are in place for the big guys, ABC, CBS, Fox, and NBC, have known for years what the writing on the wall is because they keep getting their asses handed to them at the Emmys and the Cable Ace Awards. You know, at this point, now Netflix shows are taking home Emmys because there's nothing in anybody's mind to say that this isn't a television show.
Right.
And they've also got a more – something that television has up on film is they've got a more nuanced content advisory system. This is something that's really important. You know, if something is rated MA, mature audiences, it tells you exactly what's in there. There's not any fuzzy wiggle room. There's not
sometimes
any.
Sometimes too exactly.
Well, yeah, maybe so. But you know, the thing about PG-13 is.
No, I just think it's funny that you know rated MA for obscene use of pies. You know.
Well, maybe so, but the other side of it is you've got a PG-13 movie that I have to constantly warn parents. Look, I know you think that they can handle this. And sure enough, the singular F-bomb in X-Men First Class, you know, was done for comedic purposes. It does not refer to the sex act, which according to the rating system is okay. You get one F-bomb as long as it's not describing the F.
Right.
But you can have terrifying images, prolonged, horrific, terrifying images of demon possession, murders, suspense, nail-biting terror, and that's all PG-13. And
I was actually reading that they were saying the show Hannibal, which by all accounts was just a favorite among critics, fans loved it, and it got canceled. And they were saying, you know, if Netflix had this show, if Netflix was making Hannibal, it would still be on.
Yeah, but let's talk about that for just a second because, okay, it was a darling with critics, and apparently the fans liked it, so people were watching it. Why did it get canceled?
Because not enough people were watching it for the amount of money being put into it.
Exactly.
Not enough people were watching it.
For the money being put into it.
Correct, and that's where we're talking about the versatility of Netflix come in. Netflix could take a show like Hannibal and say, you know what, we know exactly who's going to watch this show, and that's fine for us. With our subscription model, we can make the show Hannibal, make sure that those subscribers who like this kind of show will stick with us, keep paying that subscription, and voila, we now have provided them with a show that they love, whereas a network has to look at how much money are we losing because our audience is so small, again, a niche market, so we have to cancel this show.
Yeah, and it should be noted that NBC is really good about trying to keep its critically acclaimed yet not very profitable shows on the air as long as they can. The producer for that show made it very clear that NBC was agonizing over whether to keep it or not because they wanted to.
Right.
Well, an example of another, you said that they're not very profitable, but critically acclaimed shows, like what?
Was The Equalizer NBC?
Oh, God.
Oh, I don't know.
Because The Equalizer for, like, years.
Not the original with Edward Woodard or the new?
The original for years was bottom of the ratings, and they kept it on.
Okay.
Wow. I mean, if we're reaching back in the past, I mean, you know, I want to say Dukes of Hazzard probably one of the.
Well, believe it or not, Dukes of Hazzard probably had a much larger audience than any of us.
But
would
towards
care
the
to
yeah,
have.
But towards the end, it was limping along. Like, you know, they had Coy and Vance, their twin cousins that they brought in when Bo and Luke wanted more money.
How many years
did
that run for?
Exactly. Yeah,
CW I thought it was like got to have a similar situation because. You know, we're fans of Supernatural, and we still watch it. We love the Winchester boys and those actors and all that. But we, you know, you watch the shows, and it's, oh, my God. You're just thinking, how long are they going to keep this going?
Yeah.
But, my God, if it's still not on the air, and it didn't get, you know, picked up again, and they're still 10, 11 years later, yeah. They're still telling stories.
Oh, God, it's a crappy season. Oh, hey, wait, that was cool. Okay, maybe yeah. They deserve to live. Okay, now they're good
but
again.
What?
Okay, now it's a crappy season. Okay, now it's good.
That has to appeal to a very small niche audience.
I'm gonna recommend something to the audience. In addition to the YouTube video that Aaron sent out that got us talking about this, we'll put that
in the notes. Mickey, make sure. Yes, thank you, Mickey. Please be sure to get that up there.
There's another show I'm going to recommend. It's a documentary that's actually on Netflix called Showrunners. And it's a wonderful little documentary featuring showrunners from some of our favorite and a few of our least favorite shows. But, because, you know, they talk to Carlton Cuse, J.J. Abrams, they talk to Joss Whedon, they talk to the guy that did the Shield. They talk to a lot of people who worked in and do showrunning and how this has become a new thing. But there's a
Harmon, right? Don't they have Bob Harmon on that as well? If I'm not mistaken, the guy who did Community.
No. It doesn't have him.
His own documentary.
Yeah, it's a documentary about him specifically.
Harmontown.
But both of the documentary that I just referenced and Aaron's video talk about some numbers, you know. And for example, the one that struck me, and this speaks to the niche audience, they said that at its height, Breaking Bad was only seen by 2 million people, mm-hmm. And you contrast that with something like I Love Lucy, which had 33 million people watching it. Now, of course, there are other factors here. You know, it's three television stations as opposed to 200, right?
Right.
and we're separated by 50 years, where I Love Lucy is a new thing, and 50 years later, sitcoms are in the death throes because they haven't evolved.
And on top of that, back then, it was an event to get the family around the TV to watch this, and now we've got DVRs.
Is Modern Family in the death throes? Because that thing's a hit. And there's a laugh
it's
track.
It's not really a sitcom, is it?
Yeah, it is.
Modern Family? Yes, it is. Absolutely it is.
Okay.
It's not in the traditional, it's not the three camera,
right.
You know.
It's not a couch in a living room, and it's not like Friends.
But it certainly has a lot of the elements of a sitcom. But I actually, we're fans of Modern Family. We watch it. I like the way it's shot, the way it's edited.
Yeah. It's a funny show.
Yeah. But certainly they do things a little bit differently. You know, they have their format is really more like The Office, like what The Office started doing.
And The Office took a while to find its audience. They literally were not sure if they were going to stay around up through the end of the second season. And it wasn't until the end of the second season that the audience clicked. Enough people online were talking about it. They were sharing little memes and talking about jokes. And it was that third season that it took off like a rocket. But that was NBC, and that was NBC basically holding out, saying, nope, we're going to let this find its way.
I mentioned Community. That's another situation where Community is one of the smartest shows on television, hilariously funny, brilliant writing. Went three seasons pretty good, but then started dropping off. And every year there was a big old Please Save Community campaign. Limped along for another couple of seasons, got canceled, got picked up again by Amazon, I think.
Hulu.
And then Hulu. And then they ran the last season on Hulu, and it's gone. But it was sad the way it kind of ended.
They chased the showrunner away for one season.
Yeah, they did.
They did because of Chase. But anyway, to see it all come together like that and watch a show that if you have faith in it and you stick with it, you can make references to things that happened seasons ago. You can watch these characters develop. I love it when a network gives a show a chance.
Well,
they go, oh, it didn't work. Cut that, shut up. But by the way, Mickey, Dukes of Hazzard, 7 seasons.
Geez.
And it was a mid-season replacement that took over from Reb Brown's failed Captain America series in 1979.
Oh, my God.
It always comes back to comic books with us.
Yes, exactly. So we have Captain America to thank.
We did do a whole episode on the Star Wars comic books. There you go.
I totally think there's two factors here that I want to bring up regarding how this all has played out. Specifically referring to the niche markets, we have the advantage of hindsight on all of this. I realized that we'd turned a corner when Marvel's Daredevil dropped on Netflix 2 years ago. And I realized that because up until then, Hulu and Netflix were doing exactly what we said. They were resuscitating shows to give it a final season. And, you know, as much as we loved Arrested Development, the Netflix season of Arrested Development, not as good as the original thing. Of course, this was years afterwards. Same thing with Community. You know, that last season was like, well, it was nice to have for everybody to have a going away party. Right, but exactly. I don't, you know, it does not have the fire of the original because I guess they knew that this was a swan song.
Yeah, they should have done an entire season of The Darkest Timeline. That would have.
Well, the thing is the way television is being made has changed, and the two factors I think that play into that is British television. Enough of it has come over, and enough people are fans of it. That the savvy guys who are television fans and the showrunners who are TV people are looking at their model and going, so we can write an ending to this. This doesn't have to go on. British series are typically only 6 episodes long. 6 one-hour episodes is a season for a crime drama, you know, Prime Suspect, which goes back into the 80s. But right up to now, all the Netflix British crime dramas are 6 seasons. Hell,
yeah, Life
Sherlock,
on Mars.
Sherlock, for crying out loud, is 2.5 to 3 episodes long, and that's it. So, yeah. But here's the deal. Because it's quality, everybody accepts it. And it creates a demand for more
stuff.
And
the episodes are like almost 2 hours long. I mean, they're like
right.
Movies.
They're like
yeah,
tiny
they're
little
solid
movies.
So
in 6 episodes.
Yeah. Pretty much.
And
yeah.
so the other thing is the absolute domination of HBO and to a lesser extent Showtime and Skinemax for their original programming, which has arcs and storylines that converge, characters that die, and we're okay with it. You know,
Stars, let's not leave them out because they have a big hit with Outlander and Black Sails. I tend to like Black Sails, but Outlander, also very popular.
And also, I really like Spartacus. I thought the
Spartacus
was,
yeah.
was great.
Mm-hmm.
Those are wonderfully lurid, wonderfully lurid.
So those were, you know, but those are really good examples. And I think you only have to get your ass kicked at the award shows 7, 8, 9, 12, 15 years in a row before they go, oh, you know what we could do? We could change the way we're making this model because up until, I want to say, 5 or 6 years ago, the model for a television show was if we've got a hit, we ride it into the ground. That's what we've talked about this before on other shows, the jumping the shark phenomenon, right?
Yeah. They just keep it going for as long as humanly possible.
And now, because what's the one of the nice things about what I'm calling the renaissance of television is there's more content than ever before, and it's fragmented the audience, but the cream is rising to the top. Sturgeon's Law is in effect the axiom that says 90% of everything is pure crap.
Right.
So the upper, but if 90% of 10 shows is crap, that means one show is good. If 90% of 100 shows is crap, then 10 shows are good. And so as more shows become available, the waters are rising and we're seeing these wonderful shows and these weird edgy sitcoms and these interesting things that, you know, 10 years ago would have never flown, not even on cable. Much less, you know, network television. And so I love the fact that...
With the exception of Babylon 5, but they still ran a 21 to 24 episode season.
Well, right. But you know, Babylon 5 was built off of that old structure. You know, they said, we're going 5
years. But they had the ending.
Right. Babylon 5 was written to have an ending. Yeah.
Unlike Lost.
Yeah. Right. Well, I know. Anyway, we'll argue about that. But another article here, by the way, I just pulled it up. Netflix just announced an exclusivity deal for Disney's latest movies starting in September. Now, talk about a coup and talk about an alliance that's going to be absolutely formidable. In my opinion, of the huge players right now in entertainment, Netflix and Disney, have just made an alliance, and they're basically going to say, if you want to see our stuff, you want to see our movies that mm-hmm. Disney produces, it will be exclusively available on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what geniuses came up with that deal, but my God.
It's a logical progression. First we had the Marvel Studios crossover, and now they're going to be doing Star Wars.
Yeah, Lucasfilm titles, yeah. Pixar, Marvel, all Disney.
Yeah. it's amazing. It's amazing. But, you know, what you said earlier, Mark, I want to go back to that a little bit. It really did start happening. I think people, you know, the Nostradamuses out there with their soothsayer stones could have seen this happening when suddenly we started getting more and more and more channels that really didn't have a lot of content.
Nope.
So, like you mentioned, we went from three channels, three networks, to 200 channels, 300 channels, however many channels now they have. And all of them want content. All of them need content. Where are they going to get it? The networks couldn't possibly produce content fast enough to be able to fill that much of a demand. Neither can Hollywood.
They were producing substandard content. See also the Sci-Fi Channel.
Yes.
Right.
Those shitty movies, those made-for-TV movies that were an insult to science fiction.
No, you're not talking about, like, Sharknado, because that was a hit. I mean, seriously, making them because people keep watching them. Those crappy sci-fi movies that you're talking about, they get an audience. And let me stress, they cost nothing to make.
And that's why some guy's
making them on his computer.
Well, that's why they make
them. Well, he eats chili out of a bowl.
By the way, that goes back to the Netflix knowing who the subgenre are, who the niche audience is.
Yeah.
There is a niche audience for freaking Sharknado.
Amen.
And they're going to watch those movies.
Woohoo!
And sci-fi knows that.
Unfortunately, sci-fi also thought wrestling was a good niche audience for them, and it's like...
Wrestling
pulled in the money. It just is like, what?
But even wrestling has its own network now.
Yeah.
The WWE has their own network, which is 24/7 wrestling programming, behind-the-scenes wrestling programming.
Yeah.
Let's learn about the wrestling stars. Let's travel with them across country. Let's make them do a comedy show. Let's have an animated wrestling adult show.
I heard a myth once that there was even a channel dedicated to showing music videos.
Everybody is doing now. Everybody understands that they're not going to appeal. There's not going to be an I Love Lucy anymore with 33 million people watching it. Those days are gone and they're never coming back. So instead, let's find the little niche shows, the little niche audiences that love the stuff that you might be particularly really good at making. You may not, but you might be.
As much as we don't like Third Rock from the... Not Third Rock from the Sun. It's a Big Bang Theory because it's kind of, you know, whatever. It is what it is. Isn't that kind of like an I Love Lucy? Doesn't everyone kind of watch Big Bang Theory and know it? At least know of it and go, oh, that's that funny nerd show. They know it.
There are certainly exceptions to that rule, but they are now the exception rather than the norm. I think,
and they're also not 33 million. So
I think the fragmentation is complete. And
how many seasons has that been on the air? Has Big Bang
Theory?
Nine.
Eight or nine.
But at least, and by the way, so another factor that played into this is the entire cable cutting phenomenon. That is another. I mean, it's like each one of these things we're talking about is another nail going into that coffin.
Who's in the coffin?
Of the old network system, the old Hollywood system, the
one that's making five films a year with their tentpoles and making lots and lots of money. That Hollywood.
Well.
Yeah, that Hollywood, Hollywood that makes less money consistently than the video game industry. Consistently.
Okay, variety time. All right.
It does.
Listen, variety.
The video game industry has made more money than Hollywood for many, many years now. It may go back and forth. Sometimes it's closer because
it's
they
closer
do have a
think.
Bunch of billion
yeah,
ones. Well, sure, but this year, because they've had several movies that have hit a billion.
Even the stocks of the – and this is from a Variety article, written by James Rainey. He was talking about the combination of THQ, Midway, Acclaim, Atari, LucasArts, similar breakdown in the film industry. Even the stocks of the eventual survivors of the video game shakeout didn't do well during most of this period until their recent spectacular outperformance. But they didn't. They went down. They went back up.
Sure.
Hollywood did the same thing. Last year, over 25% of total box office came from just five films.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, above the average
right.
of roughly 16% from
right.
past
but,
years.
But keep in mind, not every year is Hollywood going to have a Star Wars The Force Awakens. They're not going to have every year a Civil War.
They're sure going to try.
Well, they're going to, but the point is, they can't.
Why not?
The money, that's what we're talking
well,
about.
But they're making the money, and they can only make five films,
I,
and they're making all their money back, and then some?
I'm doing okay.
Yeah, and all it takes is one bomb to break them.
Ah, the bombs. Let's talk about the bombs, because they are out there, and we do have studios that suffered from them. Studios like, oh, I don't know, Paramount. who had a horrible little film called Zoolander 2. They underperform with Mission Impossible, and they're putting all their money in things like Star Trek and the Transformers. They have to, because they tried and they failed in a couple of things. Lionsgate, remember Gods of Egypt? Huge bomb for them. $140 million budget bomb for them.
Yep.
They are struggling. They have Divergent, Allegiant, which is that series that they've got, and of course, Now You See Me 2. They're really kind of pushing that because that's one of their tentpole films, trying to get money.
But by the way, that's why people ask, why the endless sequels, why the endless reimaginings?
Sure thing.
That's why. That's exactly why. When people are getting online, getting mad about them remaking the Ghostbusters, and they're saying, that movie doesn't need to be remade, Hollywood is not about to remake something that wasn't successful. That's not their business model. It's not what they're doing.
But ironically, they remake something that was successful, and the remake is not successful.
Well, we don't know.
Well, I'm not saying Ghostbusters, but in general, a lot of remakes come out and they go,
that was
unnecessary.
No, that's true.
Let me offer a real-world example. Our longtime viewers here at the Lobot Lounge know that I own a movie theater. Now, it's a small two-screen theater in a small town. And so I'm going to, rather than give you the numbers of like the big Metroplex places, I'm going to instead give you a kind of a boots on the ground, here's Walmart country analysis. Last year was one of the worst summers we've seen, okay? Ordinarily, May, June, and July are our bread and butter movies. And the tastes of my market are very middle of the road vanilla. I don't get to do a lot of art house movies here. So outside of the
no Werner Herzog, huh?
outside of the Pixar movies, I had one big hit. Let's go ahead and use the Pixar movie. Inside Out and Jurassic World were my two big movies.
Oh, yeah.
Last summer, Terminator fell flat. Mad Max fell flat. There were two others that we got that were supposed to be tentpole films that just did not perform. And we paid, personally, a lot of money to get them on the basis that, well, it's a Terminator movie. It's going to do well, of course. So we're going to, you know, we're going to charge this money. And I had credits with most of the major studios going into November and December because we spent so much money on films that critically underperformed, and they underperformed across the board.
Mm-hmm.
So this speaks directly to the YouTube video that Aaron showed us that's going to be in the linkage. But it also speaks to an audience that is turning away from theaters for a number of reasons. Yeah. And one of those reasons is that – you know, Aaron likes to use superhero fatigue when we're online talking about this, referring to the genre. And I don't think it's actually as bad as all that. I don't know that it's superhero fatigue. I think it's blockbuster fatigue. I think that there's a point at which people hit a saturation level. And of course, I say that knowing that one of the other big movies that predated the summer season for us that was huge was Furious 7, and they had cars jumping buildings. So what, you know, obviously take what I'm saying with a grain of salt, because I do think there was a tragedy porn component to this. They wanted to see.
Oh yeah. One more time.
Yeah. That was his last movie. And so we're going to go and celebrate that. And all of them had the same question for me as they were coming out. Now, I'm not a Fast and Furious fan. I've tried to watch it several times, and I understand he was a very nice man. I didn't think he was a very good actor. just a personal thing. And also, I'm not a big car guy. So, you know, I gave it a shot. It didn't work for me. But, hey, if everybody else wants to see it, I'm happy. They all asked me, so do you think they're going to make an 8? So do you think there's going to be an 8th movie? And so that audience can't get enough.
Right.
And it's going to be that way until they perceive that they're just phoning it in, whatever that means.
Right.
You could argue that to be with any series, really.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, couldn't you say that somebody's going to say, you think they're going to make another Avengers movie? Are they going to make another Avengers movie? They're going to keep going until Robert Downey doesn't want to do it anymore, or they just they fall flat and they start phoning it in.
Oh, no,
and you're like, well, that's done.
Yeah,
we'll
absolutely.
Be making a pass Robert Downey Jr.
But,
well, we hope so. But I mean, you know, the same thing can apply. You brought up movies, so let's quote Monty Python. And finally, here are some completely gratuitous pictures of some penises to annoy the censors and to hopefully spark some sort of controversy, which seems the only way these days to get the jaded, video-sated public off their asses and back into the sodding cinemas. How in the world do you? I mean, I love going to the movies. I love the experience of going to the movies.
Yes.
I like walking in, I like smelling the popcorn popping. I like getting my cold drink and a popcorn bag and my snack. I like sitting into the theater. Nowadays, theaters are luxurious with reclining seats and leather and cup holders in the arms, and it's lovely. It's a glorious experience, and it's a gigantic screen. And I've always loved the shared experience of watching a movie with strangers, because your reactions, they share, we laugh, we gasp, we go silent, a couple of sniffles in the sad scenes, whatever, but it's a shared experience.
Yes, it's shared energy, yes.
Yeah, you enter like that dreamlike state,
yes.
And you see images flickering on the wall, and it's beautiful.
It's transformative, absolutely.
It is.
Yeah,
I love the magic of movies, and to that I will say, no matter what happens on the small screen, I don't think movies are going anywhere.
Oh, no. And by the way, that video makes that very clear, that movies will always be around. I mean, hell, there's people that still listen to vinyl, as that video says. But here's the thing. Here's the problem with that wonderful, and I agree with you. I agree. You summed it up beautifully. That is exactly how I feel. And I will tell you exactly what trumps all those amazing warm fuzzies cost. If I have a family of 5, and I want to go see the new Civil War movie.
Don't go to the LO Draft House. It's way too expensive.
And I have to add up the tickets for how much for me and my 5 family members, 6 of us, mm-hmm. to go to that wonderful theater with the plush leather seats that mm-hmm. recline, to get the drinks, to get the snacks, to get the popcorn, to get all that. By the time all is said and done, I'm spending $150 to watch a movie, and then I herd my kids out, and mm-hmm. we get back to the house.
Right,
on the flip side, those of us without kids go and have a shared experience of 4 or 5 kids in the audience screaming their head off.
Right. Or
then you should go to the Alamo
yes.
Draft House, because they don't allow that kind
yes,
of thing.
But, we either do the Alamo, or we do the RPX on a Thursday night when there's nobody
this
there.
This is a two-parter, folks. This is a two-parter. Or I go home to – I saved up my pennies – to my $2,500 Ultra HD 70-inch flat screen TV, and I gather my family around, and I wait for the movie to come out at Walmart for $9.99. I buy it for $9.99, put it into my really fancy, slick Ultra HD DVD, a Blu-ray player.
Okay. Honestly,
and
you're getting $25.
The popcorn, and I get my soda for, you know, 99 cents for the case or whatever. And now I've spent to enjoy Civil War with my kids. I've spent maybe $20. So that's
ramp
very
it up
important.
A little bit, because
first
somebody with an HD machine is not. Or
no, but that's what I'm saying. But that's what I'm saying. They have saved their pennies to buy this television.
Right.
The television is an investment that they make once every 4 or 5 years.
You lost me at Walmart.
Whatever. I was making a point.
No,
if it makes you feel better, imagine Target. Just don't go into the bathroom.
Your point is well made, Aaron, and I will say to you that you are on the other side of what I was about to mention. Here's where Hollywood lost its audience. It lost it at the theatrical level. As soon as the multiplexes started consolidating, and started doing 12 and 14 and 16 screens, they had to make some choices about the number one most expensive business expense, and that's employees. How many ushers, what's the minimum number of ushers that I can absolutely have to make sure that everybody has a good time? That's really a minimum wage? I've got to put an usher in every theater? There's no way we can do that. The payroll will cripple us. So we're going to dispense with the ushers. We're going to put some people up front. We're going to put a little thing on the screen that says, please turn off your cell phone, which nobody's going to watch because we've been sending ads onto the screen for the past 20 minutes telling you to drink Coke and buy Honda and listen to the new hip-hop mix by some lady that you've never heard of before, but they've got a lot of money invested in it, so they're going to push her on the market. And so you know, you don't even get the trivia anymore. You just have to watch these massive commercials.
Yeah, it's a commercial. It's a big commercial. Yeah.
And that experience has been diluted, okay? It used to be church. Now it's mega church. Now it's the church of the fast butt grab. It's the church of the give me some money. It's the GSM feel-good revival. And as soon as that happened, and people who were movie fans who used to love going to the movies looked at the cost-benefit analysis of I could be at home watching something at home and not having to hear the screaming kids and not having to deal with the bright light in front of me that is visible from space. So it's for this kid Snapchatting every 12 seconds and giggling like an idiot. As soon as that happened and there was no way for the megaplexes to control the experience for the end consumer, that's when there was this exodus from the theater. It was never and when less people started going to the movies, guess what happened? The first thing they had to do is the remaining people had to pick up that cost. And so the tickets go up, and then the popcorn goes up, and now you're paying $9 for a popcorn and a drink that you have that the theater has 65 cents in.
And contrary to what Joseph was saying, I would recommend the Alamo Drafthouse because that's dinner and a movie in one expense.
But that's why those theaters have evolved, I think.
Yes.
I think now there are the event theaters. There are places like Alamo, like the Movie House and Eatery, where they have to make it not all about going to see this movie, because they know people can go do that at home on their big screen TV in the comfort of their own home. Now they have to make it an event. These beautiful chairs sit like a pasha with surrounded by your friends who are also probably cinephiles who love, can't wait to see the new movie. Well, yes, I'd like some of your fine selection of beers. Can I see your menu? Ooh, yes, you have great chicken sandwiches here. I'd like to try one of those. Now it's a totally different experience.
And it's a profitable one because
and it's a very expensive one.
Yes, it is.
Because frankly, going to the Alamo, as wonderful as it is, and I can't go to the Alamo every single time I want to see a movie, I just can't afford it. Because you end up paying for a sandwich, and you don't have to. Of course, you could sit there and get the little cheapy ass popcorn and drink your drink and be happy.
Or you could go to the movie and then go eat out. So it's the same.
Right, you can do any of that stuff. Right. But it lends itself to that experience. And I'll be frank, I love the Alamo, but they had the most uncomfortable chairs in the world.
Yeah. Well, it depends on where you go. Here, that's not
Movie House is the best.
The Alamo Drafthouse in Austin, House. Texas, is what I'm talking about. Every one of them have horrible chairs. But going to, I don't know, something like a Regal cinema like the Westgate that we have here in Austin, where they changed all those seats into lovely leathers, and you can buy those buckets and get $6 bucket of popcorn because you keep your bucket and you bring it back every single time throughout the summer. It's a great deal. I mean, you can find deals, folks. Yeah. You can go on Tuesday nights to some theaters, and it's $5 night. All movies are $5 all night long, all day long, on Tuesdays or whatever. You know, I want to say that the movie...
You could drive 6 hours to the Vernon Plaza Theater where we put real butter on the popcorn.
On the popcorn.
There you go.
Not
butter-flavored grease.
That's right.
20 minutes before the movie.
And that's what it was. I mean, I grew up working in movie houses. That was my job. I went from usher to box office to concessions to manager to projectionist. I mean, I did everything that there possibly was to do in a movie theater. So I grew up in movie theaters. I love the mystique about them. Yes, I'm a big old romantic softie, and Aaron likes to blow those things out of the water, but I'm sorry. My love of this genre of going to the movies, this entertainment, will trump anything from Walmart Aaron here. It will absolutely. For me, it means more to me than just I'm going to go sit around and be annoyed by these kids and the cell phones. First of all, I'll be honest. That rarely happens to me. Don't know if it's just luck, but it rarely happens to me. When the lights go down, the cell phones go away, people watch the movie. I really don't have a problem with that. But I really love the idea that you enter that other world, that you are literally not in your house. I don't find going – I like going to see horror movies in a movie theater because it's dark, it's cold, you have a salty – it's popcorn, you have a sweet snack, and you've got the drink, and it's a little chilly, and everyone screams, and there's that energy and that rush, and then there's always that laughter that follows a good
that,
scream.
That nervous laughter.
God,
you jumped. No, I didn't.
There's nothing like it. Mm-hmm. There is nothing like it. And to that, I will say that movies, I pray to the cinema gods, will continue – I don't want them to go the way of the drive-in.
I'll tell you what's got to happen.
Still drive-ins, but I don't want them to go into those things.
Well, you know, sadly, like Roddy McDowell said in Fright Night, oh, if there only been a few more of you.
Yes.
Because sadly, that's the reality. You know, I feel like you do, Joseph. I do.
I disagree that it's the reality. I do. But I don't think movies are going anywhere.
No. There will always be movies. Everyone that talks about this makes it clear there will always be theaters. There will always be people going to the theater. But that's not really what this is talking about. It's talking about
model,
you know, right? What's going to happen to the gargantuan? And it is the gargantuan machine that's sole job is to crank out those big tentpole blockbusters, and put them out in the cinema when less and less people are going to the cinema.
I think.
What are they going to do?
This is my prescription.
Okay.
This is my prescription, and it's based on seeing this on the inside for so long. There is, like every entrenched bureaucracy, okay, you have the worst aspects of bureaucracy, and you have the worst aspects of a corporation when you're dealing with the motion picture industry. Both are in effect, and both are rampantly out of control. You cannot, at this point, they have a generation of kids that are not coming to the theaters, okay, because they're watching their cell phone and thinking that's the same experience. And you can't tell them any differently. All you can do is make your product more attractive. And so to make it more attractive, you can't necessarily cut the ticket price because they never walk backwards. All you can do from the production side of things is cut out your bloated middle. You've got massive redundancies. There's a ton of waste and oversight and horrible excess in all of these companies. That's what you cut. That's what you jettison. Those budgets don't have to be that big. You spend the money wisely rather than just keep throwing money at it. As soon as the Titanic budget was reported, when Titanic first came out, and it was the first budget to go over, I think it was $200 million. That let the horse out of the barn. And at that point, it became a rush, you know.
Because, of course, that movie did so well that all you have to do to make a good movie is throw more money at it.
Well, that's been the prevalent wisdom in Hollywood ever since Jaws. Jaws, there has been they've been chasing that elusive summer dollar. And so it's okay to chase it, and it's okay to have tent poles, but they've got to scale back those massive production costs, because if it doesn't, if they go back to making let's take it back to $100 million. Let's set that budget at $100 million.
It's an indie film, my friend.
Well, I know. But
these days.
But at this point, the computers don't cost that much. We're not in R&D anymore. We're in maintenance and upkeep. And those movies have paid for those computers to generate those special effects tenfold.
Right.
So this is the other side of this, and this is the secret thing. Everybody move in close. I'm going to tell you something very quietly that not a lot of people know, okay? Everybody in Hollywood cooks the books. Okay. No, I know. There is zero accountability and 100% opacity regarding the amount of money that's spent, where it's spent, what it goes to, the way that it's juggled.
Okay. that creates another problem. The reason that people like Robert Downey Jr. make $40 million on the one superhero film is because that's the only way he's going to make that amount of money. Hollywood accounting assures that there will never be any kind of profit sharing after the fact,
right.
Even if the movie makes over $1 billion. Right. It's always going to be in the red.
Now watch, Robert Downey Jr.
Robert Downey Jr. up front says, hey, my cut's going to be $40 million. What'd you do with your money after that? God bless you. I don't care. I want my $40 million up front.
Reminds me of Jack Nicholson doing Batman, because while he did the role of the Joker in Tim Burton's Batman, one of the clauses that he had was he got a piece of every bit of merchandise that had Joker face on it.
And more importantly,
he ended up walking away with about $67 million total.
Wow.
That was the done deal.
Because he asked for gross points, not net.
Yeah.
And merchandise, which he was everywhere.
Yep.
So it's not unheard of, and I think that we're talking about actors and names. I mean, Pirates of the Caribbean 5, which is shooting more footage now, is rumored to have broken the $250 million mark right now in the budget of making that film. You know, it's a Disney tentpole. They're looking at 2017 for that release.
Yeah, and it's going to be their Memorial Day movie.
Yeah, exactly. I do think that there's something to be said for that idiom, and I want to quote George Romero, one of my favorite filmmakers. He had a great quote about the formula or the recipe, if there is a recipe for making a movie. Some people expect that high-dollar special effect, that glorious industrial light and magic special effect that becomes idiomatic and people expect it, but that's not essential. And I believe this, have a good story, and tell it in a way that's entertaining viscerally. That's the formula. That's it.
Yeah.
What that means to independent filmmakers, what that means to big budget studios, what that means to the producers and the directors, you know, whatever that means to that artist who's bringing that in.
Right.
Now, if they feel like, I can't make this movie without, you know, $100 million worth of transforming trucks or talking turtles or aliens destroying, you know, national monuments, okay, I respect that. Doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be a good movie.
Sure. Right? Well, and the problem, too, I mean, I know several people that work in the or worked in special effects, and, you know, they'll be the first to tell you that the $250 million to make the Civil War, whatever, you know, a lion's share of that is not going to the special effects.
Right.
a tiny portion of that is going to the special effects, and that more and more they make these companies bid against each other and even make bids that they know won't work. They make bids that they understand cannot possibly work and that the special effects company will lose money. But they have to. In order to even get any money, they have to outbid the guy that's saying, yeah, I can do this amazing special effects for whatever it is, for $10 million. Oh, yeah, well, I can do it. Meanwhile, the cast with Robert Downey Jr. and Chris Evans and everybody else is walking away with $150 million.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, wow, geez. You know, Deadpool proved that you don't need a huge budget and a huge megastar. Because Ryan Reynolds is popular, but he's no Robert Downey Jr. But to make a lot of money, that movie was so much fun that people went back to see it again and again and again, and it's going to do gangbusters and is doing gangbusters on Blu-ray.
Yeah,
so I totally agree with you, Joseph. I think that
and you were talking about economy and knowing how to make a movie on a lower budget. One of the reasons Deadpool works is because the director was a visual designer before this and did CGI and a whole bunch of other things. He was able to take that entire freeway scene with the gun battles and everything and get it so that they set up, filmed for a couple hours, broke it back down and come back to do it the next day where everything's exactly where it needs to be quickly because they had to. That was the only way they can do it. And his skill set allowed him to do that and pull off something that would have cost, you know, Marvel a ton of money.
Yeah.
Not because they're
spent a week to film. Yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of in-jokes like, hey, how come there's only two X-Men here? It's like we couldn't afford anymore. You know,
right.
You know, where they're actually, you know, when he forgets the guns in Dopender's taxi cab, it's because they cut the budget and he couldn't do the big gunfight that they wanted to do. So they very cleverly disguised. I mean, it works. It works on many levels.
Well, and sadly, too, I mean, one of the areas where, you know, we haven't really touched on that much as far as what makes a movie successful, and Joseph said story. And I agree with that. As a screenwriter, I agree with that. And again, the screenwriters do not get that. Screenwriters get a tiny, tiny, insignificant fraction of the $250 million budget.
And usually ignored.
Right, absolutely. And then it's rewritten multiple times by different people they bring in. Now, it needs more jokes. It needs more dick jokes. It needs less dick jokes.
But by that time, you've been paid already, right?
Yes, yeah.
No, you're done.
They come in, you work for a week, they pay you your whatever, $200,000, and you're gone.
It's like you sell your house. You can go. You can drive by your house and go, that's my house, that's my old house, I just sold that. But I can't go and go, hey, this wallpaper is wrong.
The wonderful gentleman who wrote, John Stakely, who wrote Vampires, tossed off set from John Carpenter. Because one of the actors came to him and said, James Woods came to him and said, this set of dialogue doesn't look right to me. You're the original author of the book. Can you help me rewrite some of this? And so he did, unofficially. James Wood took it to John Carpenter, and John Carpenter pitched a fit.
Yeah,
because it's all outside of the system and outside of everything like that and everything like that.
Well,
so,
and that's part of what I think that's part of what we're addressing is that how does a gargantuan industry like that, which is used to doing something in a certain way, how does it suddenly change its model, its recipe, the way it operates in order that it can start making much lower budget, not make them less spectacular, but just lower budget films, period, so that Civil War costs $100 million, not $250 million, so that the next Titanic costs $80 million, not $300 million, mind you, the next Titanic.
So if I may, let's do that. Let's pretend that we are all big studio heads now. And drinks all around, and I'll light a cigar, and I'll sit here.
Oh, God.
Now that we've got all of you here, gathered around the big table, I know I'm suddenly British, but I'm a big studio. And I didn't get a rump out of that guy. You better watch your ass. All right, so we're all big studio heads. Let's talk about this new summer. Oh, we got these great films. It's going to be great. We're going to make lots of money, and it's going to be wonderful. Formula time. We control it. What do we do differently? How can we make a big hit movie without the $250 million price tag that's going to turn a good profit? Because what do we need to make a profit? Number one thing, guys.
Money?
To make a profit?
Yeah, to make a profit. To make a movie successful. What do we need?
Story.
A great story, yeah.
Not so much. Give me another one.
No.
Harumph. What do we need, folks? What do we need?
Camera.
Stars.
That's it. We need a big star. We need a big star. No one's going to come see a movie with no-name stars. Got to get at least one. Okay, so there's a budget right there. Let's write that down, big star.
We do not need a big star.
What, we don't need a big star?
No, we don't need a big star.
Oh, we need people to see the movie.
If you want to send a message, use Western Union. Anyway, the thing is, the fact that, and by the way, Hollywood has proven that you don't need a big star. Name the big star in The Jungle Book, the movie that's made almost $1 billion worldwide.
All the voices doing the...
Try again. Those voices could be anybody.
Back up, my friend, because in the trailer it says, featuring the voices of Christopher Walken as
Nobody
the giant monkey.
Shit. Nobody gives a shit.
You're absolutely wrong to
Nobody
give a shit.
Nobody gives a shit.
No, you're absolutely
Nobody
wrong.
Nobody gives a shit.
You're wrong.
No, I'm not
you're
wrong.
You're wrong. You gotta have names.
No,
you gotta have names.
Nobody gives a shit.
You are wrong.
The Jungle Book,
gentlemen, to your corners.
The Jungle Book could be just as successful if it had B level actors or C level actors. Really? So you think those seats are lined up because people want to hear what Idris Elba sounds like? Really? Really?
No, well, no, but that's
know,
part of their marketing.
The Christopher
their
Walken
they
thing.
Have, they have to include it.
No.
They have to include it. You can't have a no-name movie.
The point is, the movie could still be successful without having big names. Name the big – who are the big stars in Inside Out? Go ahead. Who are the big stars?
Amy Poehler.
Oh, yeah, okay. Because people line up to see Amy Poehler movies, and she her movies make $1 billion worldwide. Okay. Wrong.
Okay. You know what? I'll grant you this. You're talking about an animated feature and a mostly CGI feature.
Right.
All right? So, okay, I'll grant you that. Big hits because they're entertaining and they're family fun.
But now I'll jump on your side of the.
But
of,
for a live action kind of a movie, faces are up there.
Hell but yeah. Now I'll jump on your side, Joseph. I'll tell you who the star of Inside Out is: Pixar. Pixar has become a recognizable brand, and people say a Pixar movie. Well, that's going to be fun. That's going to be Zootopia. That's going to be Inside Out. That's going to be so people will go see.
Well, let's look at Marvel real quick because Marvel's the brand name here, and we're talking
the brand. Yes.
So Jessica Jones. Who's the big star in Jessica Jones?
Nobody.
Right.
Yeah. On the TV end of things, David Tennant draws a lot of water from the Doctor Who people.
Well,
and Harry Potter
D'Onofrio.
Although, what about Daredevil?
Star.
I know.
Vincent D'Onofrio would be the name.
Do you think he's the big draw?
He was the biggest name.
That's true.
He was the biggest name. I don't say about the big draw, but to see him, you know, and then, of course, word of mouth, the minute he came on as Fisk and started doing those amazing things that he
fantastic.
Did.
Oh, he's fantastic.
Yeah,
fantastic.
Word of mouth is like, you got to see D'Onofrio in this series.
And,
all right?
But see, but that, I think that's the sad part is that people are now, you know, we all know movie stars are a totally different thing from a great actor. And right now, the era of the movie stars sort of comes and goes. I don't know that we're in it right now. I think right now.
We're definitely not in it. We are so not in it. And don't get me started. Oh, God.
Right. No, I know. I think right now the seller are brands, whether it be Transformers, whether it be superheroes, whether it be, you know, things like that. I think that's really what audiences are more. They want spectacle, and they want something that they recognize as being particularly cool.
Is Johnny Depp a movie star?
Yes. Johnny Depp is a movie star.
Which Johnny Depp is?
And would you say that Johnny Depp draws an audience?
He absolutely draws an audience. He'll draw.
But not every time, because he said bombs.
He has had bombs, but Johnny Depp does guarantee a certain number of people will come to see the movie.
Yes, he does.
Yes, he does.
It may have only been Johnny Depp fans who watched Mordecai, but there are a certain number of people.
I'm a fan of both the character and Johnny Depp, and I didn't watch Mordecai after seeing the previews.
I think that Johnny Depp, whether or not Johnny Depp people show up to a Johnny Depp movie, depends entirely on the amount of makeup he disappears under. Mm-hmm. In other words, everybody wants to ride Captain Jack Sparrow's sword, if you know what I'm saying. Not so many people, the Mad Hatter. You know what I mean?
Right. So you're saying that the more makeup he has,
more in love with Johnny Depp's characters as opposed to Johnny Depp, the actor.
Yeah, if you see Johnny Depp in a movie and you go, oh, that's Johnny Depp, everybody's going to show up for it. It's the same. Right. To date, no one has put a football helmet on Chris Hemsworth, you know, because they know if they show.
Or even a Thor helmet for that matter.
If they know that if they cover up Chris Hemsworth's face.
Oh, sure.
We're not going to get
that's why Toby, that's why Tobey Maguire kept yanking the damn mask off every 5 minutes.
But by the way, that little clip that we're going to talk about that we're going to put in there, that talks about that, too, where the studios were thinking exactly what you just said, Joseph. Well, Johnny Depp was so popular as Jack Sparrow in Pirates. Surely if we make him Tonto in The Lone Ranger, it will be a billion-dollar movie. And it wasn't.
It wasn't because it was horrible. It was written. It was
so,
horribly.
So we get back to it. Get back to it.
All right, we're back on the
story.
Back at the table.
A
all right.
Good story.
All right, we're back at the table. All right. So
let me offer up an observation.
Okay, I'm going to cross out name. We don't need a name. Next.
You don't need a name. What we if we're doing an animated feature, you could get talented voice actors who sound enough like celebrities that people will get it.
Okay.
I think the reason why Jungle Book works is because the voices, the actors that they got to do the voices were very specific voices. You can't ever not recognize Walken. you just can't. Bill Murray is transparent in whatever he's doing, and especially Bill Murray Con Man, I think that was a deliberate choice. Okay, he hasn't done one of his likable used car salesman guys in a while, and he plays Baloo like a likable used car salesman, right?
Yeah, sure.
So,
like old Belushi, yeah.
Exactly.
Bill Murray, yeah.
I think in this case, that was a calculated decision. You know, if you have Walken singing the Jungle Book signature song, and Bill Murray using his tricks to get Mowgli to go get up and get the honey, that creates an association. That said, so, Dawes Butler used to do celebrity voice impersonations on all of the primetime animation shows, and people knew exactly that the Flintstones was supposed to be the Honeymooners because it sounded like Art Carney and Jackie Gleason.
Exactly.
Yeah, or in Zootopia with the mob boss, you know.
Exactly.
So are you saying we do need names? Because I'm confused again.
No. We don't.
No, we
don't
need the impression of names.
All right, so we get somebody dressed up like Johnny Depp and put him in a movie, and people will think it's Johnny Depp, right?
What we need is somebody with star power.
Ah, that's it. Charisma.
We need charisma. We need somebody. We need this generation's John Garfield if we're doing a crime movie. We need this generation's Fred McMurray if we're doing a film noir film.
How much money are we gonna spend to promote this guy?
We're not gonna spend any money to promote.
What?
Here's why. All we have to do is release this stuff into the wild. The internet does it for us.
Oh, the internet. We need to hire a bunch of people who will work the internet for us.
We don't got
to
hire
for exposure.
What? People are going to do it for free?
Yes. All we have to do is sign them up for the press release and send them one of our keychains. There are companies.
Wait. Keychains. That's it. Okay. I'll put a budget down for keychains.
We need $500 for keychains. That's it. All we got to do is
suck.
We'll do a standard print campaign and we'll cut a 30-second trailer for cable. But we don't need to do anything other than let the internet do it for us.
Now the property we're working on here, gentlemen, is that a real popular novelization of the Blade Singer film that's
no,
being
Dune.
Adapted.
The new Dune.
No, we're doing Blade Singer. It's a great film. A great book. I read it. Yes. This kid's got something, I say. So we're going to do this great film, but we're going to need a lot of special effects. We're going to need a lot of makeup. We're going to need a lot of transformation stuff in that thing.
I understand it. He needs to be able to sing while he's fencing, right? That's what it's about.
Absolutely, yeah. So, all right. So we need a soundtrack. We need someone for the soundtrack because we got to release a soundtrack for this film,
Colin,
right?
No, he's too expensive.
Kanye,
Justin Bieber's available.
Yeah, right. Okay, all right. So, but we want to do something fantasy oriented because we're nerds, but also because I think that the kids like that. And big summer tentpoles are generally comic books or fantasy or something outside the box. We're not going to have a big summer tentpole that's a D.H. Lawrence film. Okay, it's not going
to
work.
I'm confused. Are we lampooning the current system? Or are we trying to change it from within?
We're trying to fix it.
Oh, okay. We're trying to fix it.
Oh, we've been lampooning it.
No. Oh, we're fixing here, folks. We already crossed off name. We don't have a name. We've got it. We've got material. We've got keychains. That's what we got.
The bartender's looking at us.
Look, I
no
oh
name.
God.
All right.
How are we going to make a profit?
We make a profit by doing it the old-fashioned way. We take our money off the top with the ticket sales. We make a separate deal for licensing, and we decide that there's a certain point at which the money pays us back. And then the rest becomes a profit-sharing model for cast and crew.
How can you guarantee the profit?
We don't guarantee the profit. That's the risk.
They have to act really well.
But if we make a side deal for merchandising and we have standard deals in place for cable viewings on HBO and Showtime, the DVD market, the foreign market, we have all these standard things. If we're not having to pay back $140 million in marketing, then our profit line is hit that much faster.
By the way, guys, speaking of foreign markets, this is a golden opportunity right now, as there is an Asian investment firm, Chinese primarily, who have somewhere in the neighborhood of $1 billion that they intend to spend on creating content. And I think it's actually even way more than $1 billion. They don't have access to the Marvel characters, the DC characters, the comic books and video games and old TV shows. You know, they are looking for properties that will be just as profitable as Civil War, Marvel Civil War, but they don't have those characters. So I think there is an opportunity here for enterprising filmmakers to go to these investors with their projects. And okay, they can't be remakes of stuff because they don't own the rights to those, with original content, original material, And maybe we'll see, I'm not banking on it, but maybe we will see a return to that The Story Is King. Mm-hmm. If they go with a bunch of great projects, great scripts, and they say, okay, this is enough like whatever, Marvel characters, this is enough like the DC characters, this is enough like the whatever, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles or Pacific Rim or Transformers or whatever. But it's this other thing. Then, of course, the investors control the IP. They can then make whatever, however many sequels or prequels and spinoffs that they want to make. And it's material that we haven't seen before. Now, they're specifically looking for content that they know that a lot of their stuff doesn't translate as well to the American audience. Chinese audiences might love it. And I love it. I've always loved Hong Kong cinema. They have all the crazy, you know, the beautiful martial arts and the wire fu and all that kind of stuff, and a lot of the Asian mythology, Chinese mythology. But some of it is a little unscrutable to American audiences. So they're looking for mass audience, or I should say more of an international audience appeal, but the same kind of movies that we're watching come out from the studios. Mm-hmm. So I'm really excited to see, where is this going to go? What direction is this going to go? Because you know a bunch of guys from Hollywood who can't get their movies made over there are going to immediately go to these investors and say, well, I've got a movie for you, or I have a movie for you. Maybe we'll see more movies made by John Carpenter, made by Romero, made by, you know, other people that sort of Hollywood has forgotten and will no longer fund their movies.
That's
you
right.
know, Carpenter probably can't get a movie made. Romero can't get a movie made. Any of these guys cannot get a movie made.
Yet they refer to them as, like, you know, reverence. Oh, John Carpenter, he's a great guy. Yeah. You're not going to give him a project or nothing.
Right.
He's kind of a bum.
So maybe they can. Yeah, maybe that's where Carpenter goes. Carpenter takes his amazing sensibility and he goes to the Asian investors and he says, hell, you know what, give me $100 million and I'll give you three mm-hmm. movies.
Yeah.
So can we have a midline star?
I just figured it out, Joseph. In answer to your question, I'll tell you what people need to be looking for, and bear with me here. We need more movies like The Matrix. When that was being made, nobody knew what the hell it was,
including Joe Silver.
Well, the apocryphally, they would be getting the dailies from Australia. And the executives would call up the then brothers Wachowski and would say, we love what we're seeing. And they go, oh, great. They go, we just need you to tell us what this movie is about. Because they had no idea. And it was sort of lightning in a bottle that they let them make this movie. And they said, well, we have to make it in Australia. And they went, are you sure? And they said, yeah, trust us on this. Because they knew nobody would go to Australia. So they had the benefit of a bunch of, well, you know, I think the biggest star, you know, was it Keanu or was it Larry Fishburne? I think you could call those both A-minus actors.
Okay, all right.
And then a bunch of,
although Keanu certainly was a known quantity.
Yes, absolutely, he was at the front of the poster right next to Fishburne, and then everybody
so have a name,
and then surrounded. Yeah. With a bunch of character actors, Carrie Ann Moss, Joey Pants, you know, these were good guys who could sort of hold things together. So what you had there was an inventive story that no one had ever seen before. You had technical special effects that they were working on in a kind of a meatball surgery way, much in the same way that ILM was first putting together blue screen stuff, is where they started doing this motion capture thing. So you had technical innovation that they were breaking new ground on. You had an engaging story that actually seemed to fit the cast very well. And it was one of those stories that left you with more ideas and questions, and wouldn't it be cool if then, you know, at the end of the movie, when you walked out of that movie, you know you'd seen something different.
Yeah.
And so that's where we need to get back to, I think.
But the story, I think, is what grabbed you, right?
Oh, absolutely.
The story,
it was a story that continued to unpack
really
in your head after the movie was over.
They did innovative special effects on Van Helsing. I mean, they did they broke ground brand new special effects in Van Helsing.
Which,
as we all know, was a sore spot for most of us, especially Mark and I. But I mean, it was one of those things that
the story, right?
Right.
Yeah. Like Romero's recipe. Get a good story and tell it in a way that's entertaining viscerally, whatever that means to you.
Right. I love the there's so many wonderful little character moments, and nobody gives Keanu credit for being an actor, but there's that scene in The Matrix where he's just gotten his tutorial. They've taught him kung fu, and he goes back in because they've got to go talk to the Oracle, and as they're driving down the street, he's looking out the window, and he says, "Oh, I remember that restaurant. They used to have really good noodles." And there was this sense of longing, like, you know, I can never go back. And it occurs to me that one of the many metaphors for The Matrix is that, you know, your eyes become open to things that broaden your consciousness, but at the same time, you can't ever go back home again. Once that genie's out of the bottle, you can't pack it back in. And The Matrix is a movie that they still talk about on college campuses as being transformative. So yeah. that's a movie that had a modest action budget compared to today, obviously, that has generated bulk tons of cash in the after. And yes, it's because of the story. And it's a shame that 2 and 3 did not fulfill the promise of 1.
But, and by the way, 3 even repelled the promise of 2. It's like they went off in a completely different direction in 3.
I mean, that's why, but that's a great example. We had 2 movies, in fact, just this summer, both of them filled with spectacle and special effects and amazing special effects. But we see how 1, with a really great tight story, Civil War, just did so much better than the other one, Batman versus Superman, which did not. Its story needed to be tighter. It needed to be more entertaining. It needed to be, you know, and so, but that if there was ever a test case, if they were like, well, let's test this in a lab, well, they did it for us. They came out with 2 movies of pretty close budget, pretty close in themes and topic and content, and this is how you do it right, this is how you don't do it.
Yeah.
And so story will always trump. It's just, and again, no studio, no filmmaker sets out to make a bad film. It just doesn't happen. So with that in mind, something clearly goes wrong along the way.
Horribly wrong.
Something in the process messes up, and you get the new Fantastic Four. Because I know that, you know, I saw Chronicle. It's a solid little film.
I know we're running late, but I'm gonna just throw out one more observation here. Okay. Right now, Hollywood is in the grip of the accountants. Okay, these companies are part of mega conglomerations, and they are all beholden to stockholders, and their only responsibility is to keep making money for those stockholders. And the accountants are not creative people. That's why they're accountants. I'm not saying that they can't be creative at their job because, oh, as we said before, books are constantly cooked in very creative ways. I'm talking about being able to recognize a story from a known property. And these guys are running algorithms, and they're looking at spreadsheets to determine what the next logical safe step is. And the video that Aaron pushed around, which we are really wanting all of you to watch, made the observation that in the 70s we got this new wave of filmmaking because it was a reaction to the bloated studio excesses of the 1960s. And these guys all came in, and they all were doing realism, and it was the height of – it was the beginning of postmodernism as a movement. And so you had all these guys doing hyper-realistic stuff with modified budgets. They weren't putting filters on their cameras anymore. Everything had a lens flare to lend that verisimilitude of authenticity. And it changed things because the budgets went down, and they – were telling stories in a different way, and they had no choice but to trust this new era of filmmaking because that's what was available to them. And what we need a sea change, and I think it starts with getting the accountants back into the mailroom where they belong and out of the CEO chair. And I mean forcibly with a whip and a stool if need be. We need to just prod them like truculent lions back into the little cage. We give them some straw and some raw meat, and you crunch the numbers in silence, and you tell me if we're red or black. But we don't need your opinions on what's going to make a good movie anymore, because that's how we keep getting these sequels.
Well, and that's, by the way, that's why Marvel is doing what it's doing. Disney's doing what it's doing. They have people like Kathleen Kennedy, who knows movie making, who knows movies, who knows story. Wow. We have Kevin Feige in charge of the Marvel Universe, who knows the characters and knows what audiences like about these characters. And you know, whether you like him or not, J.J. Abrams, who's a very creative guy, and they're all helping to guide these films, Joss Whedon. And so that's why those movies over and over again are good.
And they're fans. We can't just, you know, dispute the fact that folks like James Gunn and J.J. Abrams and, you know, to a certain extent, I guess, even what was the first one that you said was even.
Kennedy. You know, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they like this the property.
Yeah.
They're fans of the property. They grew up. I know that. I know for sure that J.J. Abrams grew up like we did watching Star Wars.
Sure.
And now he gets to play in that sandbox.
Sure. In
and,
fact, J.J. Abrams was instrumental in talking Paramount into dropping their incredibly stupid lawsuit against the new Star Trek
film. That's right.
It's like, what? Who is that going to help?
So this is good stuff. I mean, I feel confident if it's in those hands. And I think, Mark, you have a good point about the accountants. You know,
yeah, the bean counter should never be in charge of the creative decisions.
Well, yes, I know. But unfortunately, we're not going to solve these problems tonight because the Lobot Lounge is going to be It is, unfortunately, time to give our drinks up. And
okay, first thing we do is we buy the Lobot Lounge.
Yes, that's how we solve this.
I don't know that bald dude with the funky earphones is giving me the eye, so I don't want to piss him off.
No, he'll call the robot. That's the problem.
I know, right? I don't want any of that
we
stuff.
Dare not face the Baron.
That's it. Well, final thoughts, guys. Let's go around our table and we'll call it a night. Mark Finn.
I think you guys, if you're a movie fan, you owe it to yourself to educate yourself as much as possible on how they're making the sausage. I think that's real important because it's going to help you. It may not change your taste in movies, but it may understand why you like what you like. And I think it's very important for us to put our money where our mouth is and where we want things to go. And so one of the things that I would stress above all else is do not give money to a movie if you don't want to see that franchise continue. If you think what's happening is bad, the last thing you need to do is plunk down your $10.50, $12.50, $17.95 for the privilege of being able to tell people how much you hated it. Just opt out.
Vote with your wallet. I love it. Mickey?
We had mentioned before that we were going to put stuff in the comments. For those of you who listen to us from iTunes or other Android podcast services, the comments that we're referring to are at thegentlemannerds.com. And if you go to the episode, there's comments underneath it.
Very smart.
Thank you for that. Mr. Odiodia, then?
I would urge people to, given the news about foreign investment from India and China, I would urge people to get onto Netflix, Amazon, wherever you can, and check out the kind of films that are being produced right now, modern films, by the Chinese market, by the Asian market. There's some fun stuff. The Chinese know how to do fantasy, and they do it very well. A lot of it is Chinese mythology, but it's fun, it's funny. Some of the best filmmakers, I think, of our generation are coming from Asia. Likewise, some of the best horror movies made are made by Japanese directors. Some of the best gritty crime movies are made by Korean directors. I mean, check these movies out. They are amazing, and they have a lot to teach American audiences.
And I would say, of course, that Hollywood will always be Hollywood, and God love it. Because don't be square, mon cher, movies is magic. And coming next summer, Blade Singer, starring Lou Diamond Phillips, Clint Howard, Tiffany, directed by John Carpenter, and with a soundtrack by Justin Bieber.
Gentlemen Nerds is a production of Cloak & Dagger Studios, LLC. Music by Ben Gibbs. The sound editor is Michael Ashley Finn. Web design and cloakanddaggerstudios.com by Rustix Interactive.
promotional consideration by some guy we found in the alley.
Good night, ladies and gentlemen, and remember, Red Skull lives.